Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is the great Armin Navabi. Armin, how are you?
I'm good. I'm actually
good.
Finally managed to, yeah.
We finally managed
prepare the list of things I want to make sure we go over during the show, because I was just, there's so many things that I want to make sure that we touch upon, and I was preparing that list. So the list is finalized right on time.
Okay, well, good. This is because this is a big topic. right now, there's Pakistan's. We're going to talk about Pakistan. We're going to talk about their secret intelligence service, the ISI. And the ISI has long been thought to support the Taliban. They've been actually known. It's an open secret that they've supported the Taliban through for ages. They actually trained the leader of the Taliban, Mullah Omar, when they were fighting against the Soviets. The Afghanis were fighting against the Soviets, and that support is that love affair has persevered through decades. They've given the Taliban money, they've given them training, education, weapons, and now, even now, the ISI is being implicated for good reason, it's probably true, in its role in the Taliban's recent takeover of Afghanistan, which is something that Pakistan was kind of banking on. It was expecting, it anticipated that the Taliban would stay in power. They kind of helped make it happen too. Pakistan's Prime Minister, Imran Khan, right, who has affectionately been nicknamed Taliban Khan at times because of his sort of apologetics towards the Taliban. He said when the Taliban took over Afghanistan that the Taliban were, quote, breaking the chains of slavery. So our goal in this episode is to really dig deeper into the Pakistan-Taliban alliance, its history, talk about the ISI, you know, which is the Pakistani intelligence service, and how all of this relates to Pakistan's dynamic with India, with China, with Russia, and all of the other sort of geopolitical actors in the region. So that is the situation.
I think we could get started by actually saying, what is the ISI? You know, right. We want to go into a little bit more detail about what ISI is.
Yeah, so the ISI stands for Inter-Services Intelligence, right? It is the Pakistan's elite secret service intelligence agency, the Pakistani equivalent of the CIA.
Okay, so. Right. And the reason why it's inter-service intelligence is because it recruits from different, from the army, from the navy, and the air force, right? That's why it's inter-service intelligence.
And also
civilians, I think. But it is the world's largest intelligence agency. Is that accurate?
Oh, I don't know about that. I don't. Is it?
Yeah, they have like 10,000 recruits, agents. There's no other intelligence agency that has like 10,000 agents.
When it comes to the number of
agents, it's the largest one. But when it comes to the funding, it's like really poorly funded.
But the thing is, usually, you know, there's a lot of people like in Pakistan, like talking about how they're part of the ISI, and there's a rule that basically if anybody tells you that they are, then they're lying because they would never talk about it.
No, but this is based on reports of like American reports that like about the ISI is also extremely efficient and has been very successful with its mission.
Oh, yeah. It's actually one of the best agencies in the world, like the intelligence agencies. Effective.
And I think only one time one of their agents has been captured. Like you don't know who they are, and you don't know their identification, their images, or there's no photos of them. So, and apparently when it comes to actually getting their agents being captured and stuff, they're one of the most successful intelligence agencies in the world. So that's pretty impressive. Having that many agents and still managing to keep them safe. That is I don't know how you do that.
Yeah, listen, the Pakistan is a country that's full of talent, but most of it comes across as doctors in the United States or these right. covert intelligence agents that go around and just bomb stuff everywhere. So that's how we put it to use. Not really much else, unfortunately. So
let me see if it's the largest intelligence agency. Yeah, go on while I check that.
Right. So,
oh yeah, it is. It is.
Huh? Yeah.
It is. So, the largest.
No, I mean, I've heard that. I just didn't know how reliable those reports are. Either way, so this has been something that's been going on for a very long time. So Pakistan, the inter-services intelligence, you know, they've worked in the past during the war against the Soviets. They were working with the Afghanis. The Afghanistan, they have a strong interest in the Afghanistan region. They have supported the militant groups there. They've supported the Taliban, and they've also created certain militant groups within Pakistan. And a big reason for that is want a government in Afghanistan, democratic government, or a more liberal government that could form an alliance with India. And Pakistan's biggest paranoia, is India.
Ali, we forgot to do a disclaimer.
What is a disclaimer?
Well, I mean, according to all the Hindutva, me and Susanna are members of ISI. So we do have to be transparent about that, because we might be, as members of ISI, we might be biased about
it. It's like you're just, you're members of Mossad, you're members of pretty much like named the conspiracy.
I am actually the most successful intelligence agent in the world, because I have somehow managed to be recruited by the CIA, Mossad, and ISI at the same time. And I openly talk about it, and people don't take it seriously. So I, you know, nobody knows about this, even though I openly say it. So it's amazing.
Yeah, it's a double. It's a meta bluff. That's what it is. Yeah. It's a meta bluff. Yeah, it's phenomenal. Yeah. So, so this is a relationship that's gone on for a very long time. Pakistan and India, for those who don't know, have been at war. They fought three wars together. Some considered, let's say, even more, there have been other skirmishes that got close. Both of them are countries with nuclear weapons. So this is particularly one of the most interesting aspects of this is how does the U.S. handle Pakistan? The U.S. has been very confused, very back and forth with what they do about Pakistan. Pakistan is a two-faced friend to the U.S. I mean, why are they that way? Because they can be. They can afford to.
So here's an issue. We keep saying Pakistan, but when it comes to talking about ISI and Pakistan, I don't think, is it fair to say that we shouldn't be using those things interchangeably? Because there's different element, there are different groups in Pakistan that they don't always have the same interests, right? So we have, when we say Imran Khan, we're talking about the civilian government.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the army, and then we have the radical Islamic groups. And these are the three main powers in Pakistan, right?
And the ISI.
Islamic group. And the ISI is part of, I don't know, like, so when it comes to the military branch of the whole military force in Pakistan, they say you have the chief, and then you have ISI, and the ISI is supposed to be like a subcategory of the military, the whole military complex in Pakistan,
but it's not.
The ISI it really reminds me of the situation in Iran, where you have the IRGC, right, and the Quds Force was supposed to be a subcategory of the IRGC. So the IRGC is like a military branch of Iran's government, right, the more ideological one, and the Quds Force is a subcategory, supposed to be subcategory of that. But the head of the Quds Force, which used to be Qasem Soleimani, was more powerful than the head of all the armed forces. He's only second only to Khamenei. Like, you're supposed, right? So I think like it's a similar. Is it fair to say it's a similar situation in Pakistan, where the head of the intelligence agency is like more powerful than anyone else in the entire armed forces?
Yeah, right? Yeah, probably. Yeah. I mean, the army is incredibly powerful. And the ISI is incredibly powerful. They're probably more allied together. The civilian government is pretty much, I guess I wouldn't call it puppets, but I mean, they're there. They hang out there. You know, the history of Pakistan has been there's a law in Pakistan. There's an amendment, constitutional amendment, that says that the president has the authority to dissolve all of parliament anytime they want, apparently. So this has happened repeatedly throughout history, that every time Pakistan has had a democratic government, it has been it's gone to military takeover repeatedly. I think the first time there was a transition, a peaceful transition from one civilian government to another was in the early 2000s, actually. Pakistan's been around since 1947. So this has been an issue. The army is way more powerful. Another analogy that's similar to is Egypt, right? Okay. Egypt is...
Okay, finish that thought because I have a question about what you just said.
Yeah, because Egypt also has a very, very powerful military. And if they don't like the democratically elected government, they're able to do things to get rid of them. And so there's a bit of a show of the civilian governments. It's a forward-facing thing, but if they don't like it, they'll step in.
Okay, so two questions. Is it fair to say that in Pakistan, we actually have four forces, not three forces? Because I keep hearing people say that two chiefs, there's not one chief, there's a chief, the army and the ISI are two separate powers, right? And the ISI is a big, more influential ones. I don't know if that's true, but this is what I keep hearing. So is it fair to say in Pakistan, there are four forces, right? The Islamic radicals, right, in the streets, and and then you have the civilian government led by Imran Khan, and then you have the army, and then you have the ISI, right? These are four different forces in Pakistan. Is that fair to say?
Sure. Yeah.
And is it fair to say that among these four, the least influential one when it comes to internal politics, I guess with foreign trade and stuff, the civilian government is the most influential one. But when it comes to internal matters, would it be fair to say that the civilian government is the least powerful one?
Yeah, the civilian government, I think even when it comes to foreign stuff, a lot of times the civilian government they can do what they want, but that's only because the other thing.
Yeah, there's allow it.
they don't really care, right? I mean, when they do care, then they make sure it doesn't happen. The ultimate power in Pakistan is really with the army and with the ISI, and they are aligned, right? There are skirmishes between all of the different things, but they are aligned when it comes to basic things like India, like the prevention of India acting in Balochistan and trying to support the separatists there, like India, forming alliances with democratically elected Afghan governments. Those are the kinds of things that they will interfere in. The army and the ISI are very, very much aligned attitude to the US.
And the ISI, I heard, is above all the Pakistani laws. Like the Pakistani laws do not apply to the ISI.
Yeah, of course. I mean, but Pakistan... Yeah. Not just the ISI. In Pakistan, there's two things. If you have a lot of money and if you have a lot of connections.
No, but that's like those, having connections and money, that makes you unofficially be able to go around the laws, right? Yeah. But the ISI is officially above the laws of Pakistan and apply to.
They run the...
No, I'm not talking about just technically. I'm not just talking about practically the laws don't apply to them. But they are... Yeah, so okay, they could do whatever they want, and they often refer to as a state within a state. And also something else I learned from you, Pakistan is, other countries are referred to as countries that have armies. Pakistan is an army that has a country.
Yeah.
Egypt is like that too.
Yeah.
Like the IRGC is hoping to become like in Iran as well.
Yeah, they've got ambitions, but they got the supreme leader to contend with. We don't have a supreme leader in Pakistan.
That's the So this is what Pakistani Taliban wants for the future of Pakistan. They want it to become more like Iran, where you have a supreme religious leader that has a control over the army rather than becoming a military state. I think that's what the future that they want.
But Afghanistan, the Taliban are actually quite comfortable with the army and the ISI the way it is right now, because they have an immense amount of support with the ISI. I mean, they're just everything that the Bin Laden. Where was he found? He was found in in Abbottabad, in a military, the equivalent of what they say of West Point in Pakistan, and he was living there for years. Okay, for years. That was protection with the ISI and the army. So either, they protected him deliberately, which is a horrible thing, or they didn't know he was there, which is an even more horrible thing. Those are the only two possibilities. Okay, so there's a, and so it's a either, it's an issue in the ISI and the army are very, very much aligned when it comes to that. But right now, the whole thing with Afghanistan has gotten especially interesting because I think that they always wanted this. They predicted it. They thought it was going to happen. They have some leverage against the U.S. There are certain things that the U.S. does want there. They do play a game like kids do if they have divorced parents who don't get along. The U.S. has given them a lot of military aid, and then they cut down the military aid by, I think, around 60% between 2010 and 2017. Right, they cut it down, but Pakistan behavior, it didn't stop. So they're
But why is it that, because Pakistan, I mean, let's be more clear, like the ISI is responsible for so many crimes, so many terrorist attacks, right? On India, there have been, Susanna brought this to my attention, that they were also linked to the attacks in France, they are responsible for, working with bin Laden. And now we know that they're also responsible for the ISI. It's not just like, the Taliban came from Pakistan. It's not that they just came from Pakistan. The ISI is directly involved in picking the Taliban, funding them, and training them from childhood.
Okay, ISI created the Taliban.
Your mic got switched to the different mic.
Did it? How?
Yeah, I don't know.
It says it's the same one.
No, it's not.
But anyway, yeah, go ahead. I'll change it here again.
All right. Yeah, so ISI is directly responsible for creating the Taliban, like as Ali just mentioned. However, the question is, why would the United States continue backing the army and the ISI? Not just backing them, but funding them. And I don't know if it's accurate to say this, Ali, supporting them over the civilian government. You know what I mean? There seems to be no consequences for anything the ISI does. Like, ISI is basically the largest attacks. The main enemy of the United States was bin Laden, and ISI was directly responsible for providing safety and hiding it from the United States. And now, United States spent $2 trillion in fighting an army, fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan. And the ISI is directly responsible for providing support and being responsible for the failure of the United States. Like, every American taxpayer should be like, we spent $2 trillion of our taxes on Afghanistan, and we're still spending money supporting the group of people who are responsible for our failure. Why is there no consequences? Why is if this was Iran, this would not only they wouldn't be treating ISI like as an ally, they would be putting, this would start a war. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no other agency that I could think of that is so responsible for providing aid, and not just providing aid, creating America's United States enemies, and yet it continues to be not only not put on any sanctions, not only it's not grounds for actually a war, it's still not only there's no negative consequences, they're getting rewards from the United States, from the American taxpayer.
Yeah.
So I think the answer to why is just one simple word, and that is nukes.
Yeah, there's a little bit more, but nukes are a big thing. Yeah.
The main answer, because Pakistan is closer to becoming a failed state than many other states, right? If Pakistan becomes a failed state, it will be the world's first failed nuclear state. And that would be extremely dangerous for the whole planet, right? Right. So if you look at the powers that play, you have the civilian government, which doesn't have any force behind it. You have the army and the ISI, and then you have all these goddamn radical Islamic groups in Pakistan. So the only thing that could keep that power, that wild card at bay, is the ISI. We can't bank on the civilian government. We need this. I think this is like a Pandora's box that the ISI has, which is like, you need me to keep this closed no matter what I do. Even if I keep funding your enemies, whatever I do to America, if you want the lid not to be lifted, you need to keep me in power. And the United States recognizes that. And that's why they want to make sure that these people remain in power.
That's exactly it. So the U.S. doesn't give Pakistan aid because the U.S. wants Pakistan to do things for the U.S. The U.S. gives Pakistan aid because the U.S. doesn't want Pakistan to not do things that they want, like to do things for other people. So the nukes are a big part of it. If Pakistan decides not to cooperate with the nuclear, you know, non-proliferation, whatever they're going to do with India, that's a problem. If Pakistan agrees, like Abdul Qadir, I think he recently died. Like he's the lead nuclear scientist of Pakistan. He's like a hero there. And he's known to help North Korea with their nuclear program. He could help North Korea with their nuclear program. Pakistan loves the Taliban. They love all these. They protect all these militant organizations and militant leaders like bin Laden. Could they not share their nuclear secrets or, you know, share nuclear assistance with them, with terrorists? So that's another thing that they're concerned about. And the other thing that's not totally related to nukes is that if the U.S. doesn't give Pakistan aid, Pakistan can go to Russia, can go to China. Like Russia's actually willing to help Pakistan with aid.
Honestly, I don't think they would mind. I think Americans would like just give them aid. Like if somebody could come and replace United States to give Pakistan aid, I think that would make United States look better because they're not directly funding the people that are responsible for the greatest cause. But they just want to make sure that this Pakistan doesn't turn into a failed state. I think that's
But if they lose leverage over Pakistan, the little leverage that they have with the aid, even though it's two-faced, it's still better than like having half of your face towards the U.S. and half of it towards somewhere else is better than having none of your face towards the U.S. The U.S. wants to know what's going on. That's a very strategic region, okay, for them. It's next to Afghanistan. Afghanistan's next to like Iran. Iran is next to Iraq. I mean, that entire region is of tremendous strategic interest in terms of defense, in terms of everything to the United States. So it's very important for them. I mean, China and Russia, for instance, will support Pakistan easily. China already does. China's a huge ally of Pakistan. And, you know, to the extent, I just want to point this out. I mean, I know Armin, you and I know this, but for the audience to know that, you know, Pakistan has called all its ambassadors out of France. They've broken diplomatic ties with France because they think France is Islamophobic because, you know, they draw cartoons and they, you know, Macron makes speeches about secularism and how, you know, Muslims have to be integrated into French society. But China is leading a genocide against the Uyghur Muslims and keeping them in underground concentration camps. But Pakistan doesn't care. Imran Khan actually went on Axios, right? And he said that it's okay, we take China at its word, that they're not doing it. Despite all of the evidence, all the images, everything, they just don't, they believe China over the Muslims. So Pakistan is essentially China's bitch in a way, right? And the U.S. basically has to do whatever they can do to ensure that they don't become, you know, it's better for the U.S. to have Pakistan 50% on their side rather than 100% towards China, towards Russia, towards the Taliban, towards everybody else. So, you know, they can at least manage when they have a little bit of a string to pull on.
Yeah, this is why it's so annoying to hear people say, why don't we just cut aid to Pakistan? Like when people are like, oh, all this internet, in all this foreign intervention, it never served us. And they just have this binary mindset of either you intervene and do things, and that's always going to be bad. It's always going to have a negative impact. Or the alternative is to do the only alternative solution is to just have no foreign intervention. Like you either do bad foreign interventions or no foreign interventions. And they're like, why are we spending money on Pakistan? Blah blah blah. And they don't know about the fact that this is not that simple, right? Yes, these are not good. These are not allies you want to be supporting. But again, the risk of a failed state with nukes is something you want to avoid. and you can't just wash your hands off of Pakistan. So it's not as easy as people make it, like, oh, just stop supporting them, just stop funding them. Like, okay, and like, do you have a solution for how you deal with like the fact that these are going to, if this whole thing falls, you're going to have like a Taliban like run country with nukes at in their hand? Like, you know, do you know how big of a threat to the whole planet that is? And it's not just about the fact that whatever comes might like be a country that want to use nukes. No, the nukes might just be like just leak out of Pakistan. Do you know what I mean? You might have like nuclear material just like all over the goddamn map after if the state falls. Like,
yeah.
And the technology all of a sudden becomes available in the everywhere, and you know that's not something you could undo. That would like the whole planet will become at like this is not just about United States and Pakistan anymore. This is about preserving life as we know it on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, go on.
No, I agree with you. I think, you know, that's what's going on. So the ISI also has, I think the India factor is a big one. And we should probably talk about that a little bit. What these.
Do you want to answer this question by Music Guy before we move to the other part?
Yeah, Music Guy is saying, I wonder why they were given nukes in the first place. Who was given nukes?
They weren't given nukes. I think, no, they came up, they made their own.
Yeah. Pakistan has had a nuclear program in place for since I think it was 1998, right, when they first started it. And they weren't really given nukes. What happened was that everybody knew that they were developing nuclear weapons. The U.S. was trying whatever they could to stop it. They couldn't. And then India decided to go ahead and demonstrate that it was a nuclear state. I think it was around my birthday in 1998. I think India did it May 28th or something, you know, or May 27th in 1998. They tested their nuclear weapons. I mean, it's like, oh, India's a nuclear state. And then immediately the next day, Pakistan did theirs. So they both had their nuclear programs. It was basically a, you know, an arms race type thing.
Hmm. Can we spend a little bit more time talking about I want to focus a little bit about the ISI Taliban relationship, because you want to move to talking about India, right?
Yeah, but let's talk about that, the ISI Taliban relationship.
All right. Yeah, because a lot of people just assume that it's as simple as Taliban being a proxy of Pakistan, or at least if they want to be more specific about the ISI or other military forces, and that's it, that's what it is, right? And I think it's not as simple as that. The relationship is all a little bit give and take, and also has changed both entities. They both had an effect on each other, and the control is not as direct and as complete as a lot of people make it seem to be, right? So it's true that the ISI is directly responsible for the creation of Pakistan ever since the Soviets came and attacked Afghanistan, and then you had a whole bunch of different groups. Like, originally, it wasn't ISI didn't pick the Taliban. ISI was funding, using the money that they were getting from the United States and Saudi Arabia. ISI in Pakistan was responsible for picking the Mujahideen in Pakistan that then would take that money to Afghanistan to fight against the Soviets, right? So by the way, this used to be, again, United States money and Saudi Arabia's money, right? And this is not just ISI giving birth to the Taliban. This actually made the ISI a big deal at the beginning. Like, before this, ISI wasn't a major organization. ISI became a big deal because of Afghanistan. ISI became, like, this is the birth of ISI. Like, so it's not like the birth of Taliban came from the ISI. Afghanistan is also responsible for the birth of ISI itself, because it was the situation in Afghanistan that motivated United States and Saudi Arabia to choose ISI as the organization that picks which Mujahideen will do the fighting. And that made ISI more and more powerful and relevant, right?
So I'm just going to quickly mention this, so that just to give what you're saying context. And I think I may have said this earlier. There's Mullah Omar, who is the leader, the founder of the Taliban, was trained by the ISI to fight against the Soviets on behalf of the US. Right. Like he was actually the ISI trained. The ISI groomed this guy who became the leader of the Taliban after. The ISI created the Taliban. That is not, you know, people say America created the Taliban, the CIA created. The ISI overtly, directly created the Taliban.
I mean, we know that part, but I'm also saying the creation of Taliban was also responsible for the creation of, or at least the power and relevancy of ISI. So the Mujahideen. The relationship, the Mujahideen, like,
yes.
The origin, yeah, so not at this
the first war the against Taliban the Soviets, was, that's when the ISI.
Yes, yes. Okay, so let me finish this point, because we're talking about a time where Taliban wasn't the main Mujahideen group that was doing any of the fighting. These were a lot of other Mujahideen group, and ISI was picking and choosing, and they had complete freedom. Like, nobody was checking, and they were picking the most radical ones, right? right. So nobody, like, there was no quality control by the United States of, like, who's being funded. Like, you pick, you know them, you pick them, you fund them, you send them against the Soviets in Afghanistan, right? But what happened is that when the Mujahideen eventually, a lot of Afghanistan at this time was dealing with a lot of women and children leaving Afghanistan and the men staying behind to fight the Soviets, right? And there was like all these men in Afghanistan, a lot of them were away from their family. And that actually kind of screwed up in the head as well, because they were like, they were separated from their families for a very, very long time. But a lot of these family, including the children, when they left Afghanistan and let the men to do the fighting against the Soviet, they went to Pakistan. The children went to Pakistan. A lot of these children were orphans or separated from, or either orphans or separated from the parents. And just like their fathers were being emotionally scarred in Afghanistan for a very long time, especially because they were dealing with like genocide level killing by the Soviets on Afghans, like things that is unimaginable. Like, I'm talking killing Afghans up to 1 million in less than in 1 year by the Soviets, and not just the fighters, but civilians, because the Soviet Union decided that we can't tell the difference between the civilians and the fighters. So we're going to just treat everybody as if they're a fighter. And they basically did like mass genocide. And Ali, I don't know if you know this, the Soviet, one thing they did in Afghanistan is that they put landmines. This is like the Soviets. And they put the landmines that were on purpose look like toys.
Yeah, I read about this, yes.
To attract children. And they made it so that the mines, when they explode, not be damaging enough to kill the children, only to disable them. Only to make, like, take off some arms and limbs, but not to kill the children, because they based on the Soviet reasons analysis, if you curse a family with a disabled child, then that family would not fight. Like, the men in that family would be focusing, like, they would be too scarred for them to be able to fight against the Soviets. So they wanted to make sure that when the children go play with these mines that look like toys, they don't die from it. They just become disabled from it, to curse a family enough to stop all these people sending soldiers against the Soviet. That was the Soviet Union's strategy. You know, so that's amazing. Yeah. Anyway, wow. So
I didn't know that part. Yeah.
Yeah. But okay. So what I'm saying is that all these children that went to Pakistan, and this is the time that the Taliban didn't exist yet, what the ISI did, what is that they were involved in the madrasas that took all these children. They took Saudi Arabia money, and they had all these Islamic teachers start
indoctrinating.
Brainwashing.
They created the madrasas. They built the madrasas with the Saudi money.
Exactly, exactly.
They weren't just involved in it. Yeah.
And when these children grew to go and then go back to Afghanistan, these students started the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So, and that is why it's named the Taliban.
The Talib means student in Urdu and Persian and Arabic, and Taliban is plural for students. So Taliban, the word, actually means students, and it's called students because they were indoctrinated with the students of these madrasas. So this was a creation of the Saudis and the ISI with U.S. money. I mean,
with U.S. money.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So,
here's what happened that it made Taliban go out of control of ISI to some extent, because it's not like it's not like they have the complete control over the Taliban, because the Taliban became more of a, at some point became more of a Pashtun thing, not just an Islam Wahhabi, you know, Wahhabi. So what Saudi Arabia sent the money to Pakistan with these madrasas, their investment was supposed to like, this is make me Wahhabis, get these kids, give me some Wahhabi fighters, right? Ideologically train them in how to do warfare and also brainwash their brain minds with just Wahhabi ideology. Okay. But there was another thing that the Taliban was influenced by, which was not the Saudi, what the Saudis intended or what the ISI intended either, is it was a mix of we're Wahhabis, but we're also Pashtun nationalists or Pashtun supremacists, right? And that was not in the plan of ISI, especially given that the Pashtun area, if you look at the map where the Pashtuns lie, it's part of Afghanistan and part of Pakistan, right? So that is a threat to the integrity of the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And a threat to the integrity of the border of Pakistan is not something that the ISI was ever intending to do, right? Because if you create a group of people that were like, we're Pashtun supremacists rather than just Wahhabis, then you're creating a Pashtun separatist movement that is a threat to the entire identity of the entire existence of a country named Afghanistan or Pakistan. And that backfired on ISI. Is that accurate way of?
Yep, that's totally accurate.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the reason why, tell me if this is accurate as well. The reason why the ISI could not give up on the Taliban even after this development is because ISI created the Taliban, but then as the Taliban grew, the Taliban influenced the low-ranking members of ISI. So much so that the ISI, low-ranking members of ISI, were actually loyal to the Talibani ideology and they were sympathizing with them. So that to so much of an extent that even though if Taliban was the growth of Taliban could have been seen as a threat to Pakistan, it didn't really matter because for these ISI members, Taliban's goals were more important than the integrity of the borders of Pakistan. Is that an accurate thing to say?
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of you know the good Taliban, the bad Taliban. Musharraf used to talk about the Pakistani president.
Right.
He's like, there's a good Taliban and the bad Taliban. They used to bring all these nuances in it. They're like Western powers don't understand it. Like a lot of that was just BS in the sense that yes, there were different factions. So there's a part of the Taliban that lived in the northwest region of Pakistan, the Pakistani Taliban, which Pakistan hated and fought against because they became a threat to Pakistan itself, right? So there's some of those people, though, they turned against it, but Pakistan was simultaneously supporting the Taliban, the Haqqanis in Afghanistan. So they were, so that's, they had this two things. They had these two aspects of the Taliban on different sides of the border, one of whom they were enemies with because it was a threat to them. And the other ones, they were allies to them because they were their sort of buffer against India.
Right. But even the ones that they were supposed to be the good Pakistan, that is also a threat to the Pakistan. And the Pakistani government recognizes that, but they could not challenge the Taliban because of how many ISI members were sympathizers of Taliban. And they would not. Like they were afraid, the Pakistani government was afraid that if they make a move against the Taliban, even the Taliban of Afghanistan, they could start a coup led by the ISI, given how many low-ranking ISI members sympathize with the Taliban.
You know what the ISI gloats about? The ISI.
No, but is it, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm answering a question. And you're right, and here's why. The ISI, one of the things that they gloat about that they're very proud of is that they take credit. They take credit for the victories against the Soviet Union and the victory now against the US. So they feel like, and one of the reasons they think that, like, we're the ISI, the most elite and the most powerful and the most effective agency in the world, intelligence agency, and covertly they believe that they're the ones who helped defeat two superpowers, first the Soviets and then now the Americans, and they've done it. So they have a very so but they have a special no, but like with the Taliban, they did it with the so they are going to have an alliance with the Taliban that they don't want to sever.
I know, but what I'm trying to point out is that the ISI is not an intelligence agency that serves Pakistan anymore. It never was. Like, they have an agenda that is, you know, like other intelligence agencies in United States, like CIA is supposed to be defending United States, or Mossad is supposed to be defending Israel, right? ISI is actively doing things that puts Pakistan in danger. And the Pakistan's government can't do anything about that because ISI is so powerful that if you do something that ISI doesn't like, it might start a goddamn coup. And this is why they refer to ISI as a state within a state, because its agenda does not really align with Pakistan's interests. I mean, one of the greatest threats to the integrity of the borders of Pakistan is the Taliban. But again, ISI cares more about, this is what I'm trying to say, is it's not just that the ISI influences the Taliban, their relationship goes both ways.
The Taliban the ISI is very changed, loyal. They're very
the Taliban
faithful
changed
to them.
ISI. Yeah, they're faithful to them.
They're very faithful to the Taliban because they know that the Taliban, this is what I'm saying, it's connected to that. The Taliban has been the ISI's instrument, and they've been their vehicle and their way through weapons, through education, through actually creating the Taliban. The ISI created the Taliban, which went and defeated a second superpower now in Afghanistan with the help and the aid of the ISI. So the ISI is going to have a lot of faithful, a lot of loyalty to the Taliban, and they will be influenced a lot of times with them. If anybody says we need to kind of distance ourselves from the Taliban because they're not good for it, they'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, these are the people. Right. Have you seen what we've achieved through these people? I mean, there is an alliance there that's actually much stronger and stood the test of time. Than they have with Pakistan. I mean, they know how weak Pakistan is.
It's not as simple as a lot of people saying that ISI controls the Taliban and the Taliban is a proxy of Pakistan because of how much ISI controls the Taliban. Because if you look at the details, it's also Taliban also controls ISI. So the relationship goes both ways. It's not that
they need each other, right?
Well, I mean, okay. So another example of how big of a threat. I mean, this was even before the Taliban taking over Afghanistan. We knew about this, but now that is even more true because the victory of the Taliban in Afghanistan is now a great threat to Pakistan because of how much. Remember, we mentioned the four forces. We have the Islamic radical groups in Pakistan. We have the civilian government, and we have the army, and we have ISI in Pakistan, right? So one of these groups that we haven't talked about right now is all those radical Islamic groups in Pakistan. The victory of Taliban in Afghanistan is now going to embolden all these Islamic militancy in Pakistan. And that is a major threat to the existence of Pakistan, right? Especially given that the civilian government can't do anything about that. That threat of Taliban to the existence of Pakistan is now even bigger than before, but a lot of people are treating this as this is a great victory for Pakistan, but it's not necessarily so. It's a great victory for ISI, but not for Pakistan. But yeah, go on.
I don't know how much I don't know if we can draw that distinct a line between all these groups, because it's not just, you know, the threat. Yes, sure, you know, your point is valid, but there are other things. Like, if the Taliban are not in power, right, the other groups in Afghanistan that could come to power are going to form alliances with India. India is going to encourage separatist movements in Balochistan, which Pakistan is terrified of. And if Afghanistan has a favorable government with India, then they're going to help aid that. Right? Then there are other factors.
I'm actually
too.
Talking about Islamic groups in Pakistan.
Okay, so let's take one. Let's take one of them. Sorry, it was a little bit of I didn't mean to interrupt. But so the Lashkar-e-Taiba. Do you know who those are? The Lashkar-e-Taiba who actually carried out the Mumbai attacks. They're also very, very close with the ISI. The ISI helped that attack happen. Okay. So these are also militants. Okay. And they are very closely linked to the Taliban. In fact, the Lashkar-e-Taiba, right? They have a lot of, there's many, many of their fighters are actually embedded in the Taliban, right? So there are all of these things. There's a lot more overlap. There's a lot of more interlinking between these groups than is readily apparent. And this is a, you know, it's a problem for the people of Pakistan, but I don't think, I think the ISI, by forming these alliances with these militant groups, feels that it is protecting Pakistan's integrity. And it's more of a risk and benefit analysis, right? It's not that, the alternative would be much worse. If they did not have these alliances with the Taliban, then the alternative would for them be more of an existential threat because it would empower India, because India would have alliances with, you know, the other groups in Afghanistan if the Taliban weren't in power on both sides of the border, and Pakistan would be sandwiched in the middle, and it may lose one of its provinces. So, yeah, so that's the kind of play, that's the trade-off that they're making. So I don't think the threat to Pakistan from the Taliban is nearly as much as what they perceive the threat to be if India formed alliances with a non-Taliban government in Afghanistan. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm not saying the threat is like there's a high probability that there's going to be a successful separation or anything like that. But separatist movements, if they're emboldened, they will be a headache for the country, even if the mission, when I say like this is going to be a threat to Pakistan's border integrity and stuff like that, I'm not suggesting that there's any chance that they're ever going to be successful. But the fact that the threat would be there will cause so much, there will be a huge cost. There would be instability. There would be security threats. Like these threats don't have to actually be successful for them to cause the damage that they can. You know what I mean? Like I don't want to exaggerate their chances, but their mere existence and the motivations will exist for more of them to show up. And you could be a small relative to a country. You could be a small force that causes a lot of damage, even though if the goals that you have never come to fruition, right?
Sure, yeah. And that makes it a choice between bad and worse. So, you know, you're going to have, you know, every alliance you have, you're like, okay, I have this alliance. This gives me maybe a 70% advantage, and there's a 30% risk, and the other thing's going to give me the opposite. So that's how
you... Do you want to add something? Because we need to... I have two other things to point to, and then we have to go to the Patreon questions. But I want to make sure you get the points that you wanted to bring first. You're muted. Okay, so you're muted. So I'm going to mention
I'm good. I'm good. Go ahead.
All right. So one thing that we need to, I just wanted to make sure we highlight was the fact that the ISI visited Afghanistan to meet with the Taliban right after they took over Kabul. Like they were, you know, so. And that was so telling about how much ISI was invested in making sure that they have a say in the formatting of the government of the Taliban in Afghanistan, right? Like, because we already talked about this in previous episodes, that there's like a competition between which Taliban comes into power in Afghanistan. You have the Kandahari, Doha negotiating Taliban, and then you have the Haqqani network. And the ISI doesn't wants to make sure that whatever Taliban is in power, it's a kind of Taliban that is loyal or has influenced by ISI. So the fact that they just like showed up, they're not even attempting to hide the fact that they have a direct say in the formation of the government in Afghanistan. They're just like openly, you would think for an intelligence agency, if they were interested in keeping this under the radar, they would come up with a different way. But they're like, no, we just flew there. The head of ISI just like, we're just going to show up, and we're just going to transparently in front of everybody's eyes just talk to the Taliban right at the point where they're trying to form the government. That was very telling, and just like, this is not even a hidden secret anymore, right? So and that's one thing I wanted to point out. Another thing, if I want to remind everybody about what happened 6 years ago in Pakistan when the Taliban took out, was it 6 years ago? I think it maybe 7 years ago. when the Pakistani Taliban attacked a school and killed a lot of school children, and how unpopular the Taliban became in the eyes of Pakistani because of that attack. And it was like, even with an attack like that, and even though so many people's opinions of Taliban had changed because of that attack, it didn't change the level of support that ISI has for the Taliban. Like, even after an attack like that, when it was so unpopular for you to defend the Taliban after that in Pakistan, but none of that deterred the ISI. Like, it doesn't, like, a Pakistani opinion doesn't really matter.
That's where a lot of that narrative came out about the good Taliban and the bad Taliban, right? I mean, they said, well, this is the bad Taliban because they're the Pakistani Taliban. They're fighting against us. The good Taliban are the ones in Afghanistan because that's our buffer against India. But the thing is that the good Taliban and the bad Taliban actually get along. The Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban, they're still the Taliban. They share family, they share like a line, everything, they get along. So one of the advantages, one of the risks that Pakistan has right now is that the Pakistani Taliban is going to be empowered. Another actually really big risk that we didn't really get to talk about, but should be mentioned here, is that the victory in terms of, you know, what you're saying, risks to Pakistan. The Afghan Taliban and the Pakistan Taliban are very, very, very anti-Shia. Extremely anti-Shia.
Oh, and yes.
Pakistan is a major, major haven. Like, it's where sectarian violence happens. And they know that one of the ways to really bring down Pakistan and cause chaos and instability and all kinds of issues in Pakistan is by, you know, just lighting a fire under this whole sectarian conflict that exists in Pakistan in perpetuity, right? So that's also a way that so the Taliban, they do have a lot of leverage if they want to mess around with Pakistan. So the ISI, they're all very aware of it. They're aware of the fact that there's potential to create tensions.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, and also this whole anti-Shia thing is like the Taliban in Afghanistan is trying to figure out how anti-Shia could go, because it needs international recognition, but it also needs to be careful not to lose members to ISIS-K, which makes this whole protecting Shia community narrative by the Taliban as one of the main recruiting, like, being not attacking Shias is the best way. So a lot of people think like the Taliban in Afghanistan, if they talk to Americans, that would be the best recruiting strategy for ISIS-K out of Taliban, but it's actually talking or not attacking or defending the Shias that is even more important to them than that.
Yeah, this dynamic between the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, and the ISIS-K is going to be super interesting, because Russia's involvement, Russia is actually willing to support the Afghan Taliban, right? Sort of, you know, behind the scenes, but they don't like ISIS-K. They don't like ISIS. Right. They don't like ISIS at all, because they support Syria, they support Assad and everything. And so they also want, they want them to distance themselves from ISIS-K, and they're also going to kind of.
Well, I mean, they are extremely different. So this is why it's so confusing for some people about the relationship between Taliban, Afghan Taliban, and ISIS-K, is because they can't be any more similar and different at the same time. Okay. Because ideologically they are so fundamentally against each other, right? But yet member wise they keep hopping between them, and they're both extremely Pashtun. They both have the same members that they are members of the same families. You have like brothers, one in Taliban, one in ISIS-K. You have like fathers and sons. And you have people shifting their minds about, okay, am I Taliban? Like one is the nationalist movement, one is the global movement, you know what I mean? One of them, but they're the same people, even though the ideas do not match with each other at all. Like they are philosophically, they disagree with each other, and they hate each other so much so that ISIS-K considers a Taliban ex-Muslim murtads. But when it comes to individuals, and you see how mobile and flexible jumping from one to one is, like, wait, are these the same groups? But then, no, when you look at it ideologically, like, no, they're not. They're completely, they're mortal enemies. So that's why it's kind of a confusing issue for a lot of people who are like, because they look like each other. And this is also what they're the same people. And even though, like, philosophically they're completely against each other, when it comes to the average fighter on the ground, they're not like, it's all about their feelings at the time. It's not about, like, if you are like a, I don't know, 20-year-old fighter with a Kalashnikov in your hand, you're not like following, like, let me see what is the philosophical argument that, you know, that is the Taliban is making to me, and what is ISIS-K making to me? You know what I mean? Like, it does have some influence, because they do pick some bullet point narratives and they're like, oh my God, look, this is what they're doing. This is what they're doing. That's why you should join us. But for a lot of these people, it comes simply down to who lets me die, actually. Who lets me fight? Who lets me die? Did you know a lot, for a lot of them, and also who's, you know, who's loyal to me, who's betraying us, who's giving us the vision that was promised, or are we now becoming corrupt ourselves? A lot of them are Puritans, unlike the other tribe, you know, a lot of, you know, tribal soldiers in other groups that are just like looking where the wind is blowing and joining whatever group is winning. The people, the direct members of Taliban, they actually do ideologically, are ideologically loyal to what they're fighting for. They just want to make sure they're under, like, once, for example, one of the concerns of a lot of Talibani soldiers was that the war is over and they lost their chance at dying. And that is actually a major recruiting tactic for ISIS-K as well, because these, a lot of these people want to actually become martyrs. And they were talking to their, you know, war chiefs, and they're like, are we really, like, as if they're terrified about, is the war really over? Do we really not get to fight anymore? A lot of these people don't know what to do with themselves if they don't have a gun to point at somebody and shooting. Like, keeping the peace doesn't really match what they were trained and raised to do. These were like, yeah, born jihadis, like raised jihadis, not born jihadis, but yeah. But anyways,
born and raised jihadis. Anyway, so should we go to pin questions?
Yeah, we got D sent us this. By the way, for everybody that might be listening to this later, the audio version of it, I just want to remind you that you don't have to, if you're a patron and you want to make sure that your questions get answered, patrons get to send us their questions ahead of time, and we do answer every patron question. So if you think, like, as a patron you can't be live here with us to answer questions live, you are able to just send them ahead of time and make sure that we answer them, right? So we have a question from D here as well. So and also, if you want to become a patron, link in the description, but go ahead.
Yeah. So D is saying, it has been reported that TTP, which is the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, it's Pakistani Taliban, has stepped up killings of law enforcement, 44 attacks in the first 6 months of this year. What is the dynamic between the ISI and Pakistan law enforcement agencies? So what is the, yeah, what's the dynamic between ISI and the Pakistan?
I actually didn't know that this there has been a stepped up in the killings of law enforcement by the TPP. So did you know about this?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that either. Okay. The TTP, the Pakistani Taliban, they don't like Pakistani law enforcement. They don't like the Pakistani military. The Pakistani military was actually bombing the TTP SWAT in North Waziristan before, right? So the TTP is not like the Afghan Taliban. So,
but doesn't this confirm what I was saying is true then? Because I was saying that the victory of Taliban in Afghanistan is going to embolden these Islamic militancy in Pakistan. And yeah, I think the TTP stepping up its killing of law enforcement in Pakistan could be an indication of that being true. So this is why I'm saying the victory of Taliban in Afghanistan, a lot of people think this is a win for Pakistan, but it's actually maybe just a win for ISI, but not actually for Pakistan. This is actually a threat to Pakistan, as we're seeing right here.
Well, I think that the risk, like, this is a byproduct of it. And you're right, like, the TTP, and this is, you know, what I was saying later on too, is that the TTP, that the Pakistani Taliban and the Afghan Taliban are not really, I mean, they do get along, right? But the Pakistani Taliban really does not like Pakistani law enforcement. They don't like the Pakistani military. The Pakistani military was bombing them in North Waziristan, right, just a few years ago. So they have some, you know, they have bad blood between them. Whereas the Pakistani military and the ISI does kind of support the Afghan Taliban. So they're sort of playing this game, and it's really a matter of, they know that it's going to empower the Pakistani Taliban, but there's a higher risk of not having the Afghan Taliban there for both Pakistan and the ISI. So in some cases, yeah, their goals are disparate, but on the other, the ISI does need to protect Pakistan as a state. It's not like they will completely abandon Pakistan and
I'm not saying that the ISI is motivated to make Pakistan fail. I hope nobody thinks I was suggesting that. They do, of course not. I'm just saying it's not their main, it's not like sometimes they do things that it's more in favor of their ideology. Like, this is a very ideologically driven, like, usually intelligence agencies are not this ideologically driven. They're actually just like very robotic, very like mission successful, you know, kind of attitude. This is the ISI is more like the intelligence agency in Iran, which is the Quds, which is very much ideologically driven, right? So, and there's what I'm saying is not that they're actively trying to work against Pakistan's interests. What I'm saying is that their agenda is so in line with the radical Islamic ideology that they have, that if that sometimes come at the expense of the best interests of Pakistan, they will go with that interest. That would become a in some instances that would take priority. Actively like hurting Pakistan, like they're like, oh, let's destroy Pakistan, not like that.
Look, the other thing for D, just to, you know, just one more aspect of this question is that there's no real black and white alliances here, right? So you have the Pakistani Taliban and the Afghan Taliban who have some differences, but they also have alliances. Pakistan does not like the Pakistani Taliban. They fought against them. On the other hand, they fought alongside the Afghan Taliban, which is why they think that both of these things are so different. On the other hand, you have ISIS-K, which doesn't really like the Afghan Taliban and probably has a little bit more in common with the Pakistani Taliban. The ISIS-K is also probably more aligned with, well, then you have the Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is aligned with the Afghan Taliban. So there's whenever you are going to support one of these organizations, the ISI does, they are going to see if they can afford the risk. And they made a calculation that, okay, we are going to help the Afghan Taliban gain power and we're going to facilitate it. We're going to make it happen. And there are risks that will come with that. And those risks, mm-hmm. you know, any action you take there will be a risk that will potentially harm you. And they have just taken the benefits over the risks. That's all.
I just want to be clear about the comparison I made, because somebody might get like, oh, but Armin, you're wrong. But okay, so I just want to make sure that I get this. When I compared the ISI to Quds, the Quds Army in Iran, Quds Force, sorry. I just want to make sure clear that it's not the same. I was just talking about them being ideological. One of the main differences is that the Quds Force is a lot more clear about Quds. It's more unanimous, it's more clear, it's more coherent. There's less like internal divisions. Like the Quds Force, we know what their ideology is and what their interests are. They're clearly like, you know, so with ISI, it's kind of like more like, well, based on this action, we can guess that they want this, but the lower rank want this and the higher rank want this, and these people are afraid of this. And it's not like, you know, like the ISI would not have come and say like, oh yeah, we're in support of the Taliban in Afghanistan. They would not like, I mean, we know that, but they wouldn't come and like say it like that, right? Is it correct? Like they would never openly say it like that, right? But when it comes to the Quds Force, it's pretty much out in the open. They're clear, like, oh yeah, we want the destruction of like a country that I'm not going to name because YouTube might think like I'm saying it. And you know, they're clear about the fact that they want to, you know, have as much influence in the region. So those are and they're openly brag about it. So it's not like they're trying to hide that. So that's the difference. So you want to read what Susanna said?
Susanna is saying, how is Pakistan not on the state sponsor of terror list? Good question. She's saying, I know in real life it's not that so simple. She put that in parentheses. And you're right. It's not that simple. So the U.S. absolutely can do that. They can designate. I mean, Pakistan's also a strategic non-NATO partner for the U.S. It's a non-NATO ally. They could revoke that designation as well. And they could revoke, they could put Pakistan on the state sponsor of terror list. But the problem is that Pakistan is, and that could actually, if they do that, then that could encourage Pakistan to actually make more attacks against the Taliban as well. But the U.S. actually has important strategic interests in Pakistan, right? So aside from, forget about the Afghanistan thing, the U.S. wants to, Pakistan's a nuclear state. So as Armin said,
yeah, nukes, we mentioned,
right? Pakistan is going to, you know, they want to make sure that they control that, that those nukes don't get into the hands of terrorists. They don't want Pakistan to start like developing its nuclear proliferation programs again. They want to prevent a Pakistan-India war. They don't want a Pakistan-India war. That's in the interest of the U.S. They don't want more Pakistan-sponsored terrorist attacks in India. There's a lot of interest that they have. And then overall, the U.S., you know, they do want to encourage like a pluralization, stuff like that in Pakistan. And, you know, that helps the U.S. strategically, but even though that's more of a minor thing. Right now, right. The U.S. doesn't seem super interested in it, as we can see with the Afghanistan thing and Biden kind of taking off. But overall, there are a lot of interests that Pakistan, that the U.S. has in Pakistan. A lot of them have to do with nukes. A lot of them have to do with staving off China and not strengthening, you know, having a strategic blind spot in that region. And Pakistan is sort of one of their seeing eyes. The U.S. is seeing eyes in the region.
And so the Mumbai attack, right, that happened, that was directly planned and coordinated by the ISI. Is that correct?
ISI and Lashkar-e-Taiba. Lashkar-e-Taiba is basically an ISI client, right? So they fight in Kashmir against India. This whole thing is related to Kashmir. The Mumbai
That was a terrorist attack. That was like the worst terrorist attack that we know of I know of in India.
Yeah,
And also, is it true that the attacks in France, you know, the terrorist attack in France, that was directed by the ISI as well?
That I don't know. I know that the attacks in France were the Paris attacks were the ISIS attacks. Like they were actually directed.
Yeah, but that was directly influenced and funded and supported by ISI.
I don't know about that for sure.
Okay.
I haven't read anything about it.
So we know. So that one, Susanna saying, I think Susanna. So then that's actually something I didn't know. Susanna actually showed me the information behind that. So there's that one. And then we know that the ISI is responsible for providing safe harbor for bin Laden. And we also know that the ISI is responsible for supporting Taliban, which is recognized as a terrorist group. I mean, if this doesn't make... And ISI is state. I mean... When we say Pakistan is a state sponsor of terror, this is us not like like exaggerating and just being like, oh, these are bad people. This is like by every definition of the phrase, Pakistan is a state sponsor, like intention. Like so, when we talk about, for example, United States' role in the creation of Al Qaeda or ISIS or Taliban, this was like these were blunders. These were not like. United States are like, oh, let's make a terrorist group. But when we're talking about the influence, when we're talking about Pakistan being a state sponsor of terror, this was planned.
This was
intentional.
Right.
Yeah, this was intentionally sponsoring terrorist groups. So this is why Pakistan is officially a state sponsor of terror, and nobody declares it so. It's not just United States not declaring Pakistan a state sponsor. France is not doing that. I mean, is India doing that? Is India defining Pakistan as a state sponsor of terror?
I don't know.
Because
don't
they
know
should.
Yeah, probably.
So it's weird. Like, it's weird that it, yeah.
But I mean, again, there's a risk of the U.S. has to think very carefully before they call somebody a
state sponsor. Yeah, I mean, I understand. I understand. Guys, I understand why they can't. By the way, it's really obvious why they can't, even though technically, we all know Pakistan is a state sponsor of terror. If you designate Pakistan as a state sponsor of terror, that means you cannot do any trade with them. You can't have any relationship with them. You can't do anything.
You cannot have any control over their nukes. You can't have any leverage over what they do with their nukes. That is the number one thing.
So it's understandable why it's obvious so obvious that they are a state sponsor of terror. It's obvious why you can't declare them to be such. So
right.
That's, so why, that's saying, why Sue said this. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. So D is saying it seems ISI is supporting that which is harmful to their own country. So yeah, we addressed this earlier.
We addressed it, yeah.
Yeah, they're taking a benefit risk calculation, and the benefits have certain, you know, risks and adverse effects that they're dealing with. D is also saying the U.S. did not create ISIS. I've argued this a gazillion times. Yeah, the reason that people say, like Armin's saying, they think like these blunders that the U.S. does, you know, the U.S. in the sense that, you know, they went, they took, there was a, like the Iraq was basically like a pressure cooker and had this lid on it that was Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party, right?
Come on.
No,
I mean, U.S. is responsible for the creation of ISIS. That's, I didn't say United States create, like, okay, so it's not like United States created ISIS, but United States is, among other countries and among other factors, United States is for sure responsible for the creation of ISIS. I mean, we know that.
Well, yes and no. I mean, in the sense that the way that we saw things play out, look, hear me out.
Ali, yes and no means partly yes.
Well, no, it may have been no. Look, here I'll just explain really, really quickly what I'm saying. The U.S. went into Iraq, they took the lid off of, you know, the Saddam Hussein off, and then all these sectarian, like this craziness went all over the place, and then ISIS emerged out of that, right? Emerged out of Syria and Iraq. So that's one way of saying that the U.S. may have facilitated the creation of ISIS. Excuse me. On the other hand, if the U.S. hadn't gone into Iraq, right, then the Arab Spring was happening. You would have had this uprising against Saddam Hussein, like it was happening all over the Arab. ISIS could have emerged from that, like it did in Syria against Assad.
You could say that about any
Armin, yeah. Assad, the U.S. did not remove Assad from power, but ISIS went up against Assad. It could have the same thing, reasonably.
That's not my reasoning for why United States created. It's partly responsible, among other things. It's not just the fact that they took the lid off, okay? Because, yes, even though it was also in Syria, it was motivated and started by that whole lid being taken off, okay? But, yes, it's also one reason why United States is responsible is the removal of Saddam. But it's also because of the fact that ISIS is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda was started by the funding of United States and Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan, okay? So given that ISIS is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, it goes back to the United States being responsible for that. So you can't, that would make United States responsible for ISIS.
If you want to make, those associations, all I'm saying is that there is a plausible path to the creation of ISIS without U.S. intervention in Iraq, which is the main thing that people cite when they make this claim. But yeah, if you go back to Al-Qaeda and then you go back to the Mujahideen and the empowerment of all of that. Then
another way United States is responsible is that the head of ISIS was literally started his movement in a U.S. prison.
In Iraq.
You know. In Iraq, that his networking, all of the people that he kind of got connected by to be able to start this whole process was because United States facilitated the place where he gets to be in touch with all the people that, you know, started the whole thing, right? So that's also somewhat responsible. So the three ways United States is responsible: the whole Iraqi instability situation that United States started, United States being responsible for the creation of Al-Qaeda, and also the networking environment that United States provided for ISIS to start. Three ways United States is responsible.
Yeah, D is saying, no, ISIS was created in Iraq, and U.S. left space for the creation of ISIS. And I kind of agree with that. That the woulda, coulda, shoulda thing, as you said, it's hard to tell, you know, what would have happened otherwise. Susanna is saying, exceptionally excellent episode today, boys. Yeah. Wow. I know. Thanks. This is a really interesting topic, and, you know, it's going to develop a lot. But we do have to have, I think, the next episode, Armin, we have to talk about the rise of Muqtada al-Sadr in the elections in Iran. I mean, that's awesome.
Yes.
In Iraq. Yeah, the Iraqi elections. Yes. And Muqtada al-Sadr, the guy who led that thing against the U.S. Occupying forces, is now coming to power. I mean, it's just fascinating. I like, you know, you already had this thing with Afghanistan where the Taliban came back, and now you have there you have Muqtada al-Sadr coming up, and which is so just Iraq, Afghanistan, the two major wars. Let's see what happens. I think that's the next thing we talk about in the next episode. It's going to be fun.
Yes, and then after that, I think we should talk about the tensions between Azerbaijan and Iran.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. That I don't know that much about, but okay. We'll do that. Okay. Susanna saying, who needs LinkedIn when you have prison? That's correct. It's a great networking opportunity. Thank you, America, and your black prison sites.
Decent. Yeah, I don't know. We might take that in. I don't know. Sure. Let us look into it. We might do an episode then.
Yeah. All right, guys.
All right.
Thank you very much. This was a lot of fun. This is a fascinating topic. I think next time when we revisit it, I'd love to get Harris, Sultan, or Sean back on to talk about it.
Yes, that would be great.
Too late notice if I did it this time, but we'll do a.
Can we also do an episode maybe on the and go back to do ideology as well a little bit? And I'm thinking like talking about the worst parts of Hindu scripture. I think we should do an episode on that.
Oh yeah, I'd love that. I'd love to talk about the worst parts of Hindu scripture. It'd be awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
But any, you know, like whatever part we talk about, like they'll all say, "Well, this isn't part of Hinduism, right?" But anyway,
I know.
It's just like the Muslims do. It's, you know, just, who knows the difference now? But yeah, we'll do that. So if you guys are watching this on YouTube or listening to it on YouTube, please like the video first of all. Just simple thumbs up, like it if you really did like it. There's a subscribe button. If you want to see more videos like this, subscribe and hit the bell so you get notified every time we make more videos like this. And we have clips like this up pretty often on YouTube. So there's always like really, really good content for you to devour. Also, if you're listening to this on your podcast app on, you know, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever, give us a rating. That helps feature us higher so that more people can know about this podcast and more people can listen to it. It's more higher profile. And if you aren't supporting us already as a patron, please do consider going to patreon.com/SJME and becoming a patron for as little as a dollar a month. You get about 5 episodes, sometimes 6 every month. You get to watch the videos and take part in the live streams. If you are not able to take part in the live streams and add your comments, then you can submit your questions under the Patreon posting of this and submit your questions ahead of time, and you will be the first to have your questions answered when you do that. So please do consider all of those things. Thank you for listening, and you know, really appreciate it, and we're going to see you next time.
Yeah, thank you all. Be best. Bye.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends, write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions, or head over to secularjihadists.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.